Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast. Here to talk all things Arsenal is your host, Matthew Wade.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. And this is a special Daily Canon Weekly Podcast because we have a special guest. Yes, we have a genuine sports writer with us, someone who actually gets paid professionally to do this for a range of different publications, websites, etc. We have Ryan Baldy with us, who is a freelance sports writer who writes for the BBC, The Guardian, also occasionally Independent, and also World Soccer Mag, and is also the author of a very exciting book that we're going to tell you all about very shortly. But firstly, Ryan, how are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Really looking forward to having a chat.
Great. Well, just on the subject of the book that Ryan's written and will be being released very soon on the 5th of August, it is called The Dream Factory: Inside the Make or Break World of Football Academies. And that's available for a number of different places. If you get it on Amazon and a pre-order, you get money off. So that's just a little plug there. But obviously, the more that we all get engaged in football as fans, and we have a different relationship with our consumption of football as a sport, particularly that anyone who's listening to a football podcast in their spare time, it goes probably a bit deeper than it did when in our respective childhoods. And so people are much more interested and much more aware of academies and the development of younger players. You know, the very fact that someone who's 16 can have maybe hundreds of thousands of social media followers and sponsorship deals, and already, you know, when I started watching football, I'm sure it was the same for you. You didn't really hear about people until they were sort of getting very close to or in the first team, you know, 19, 20, 21. And obviously we've seen a seismic change, and not just with the information age, but also within English football with the real introduction of the academy system. So, just before you sort of deep dive into anything in particular, Ryan, just tell us a little bit about the book and more importantly, just to give people some context about who it was you actually spoke to and which academies you really had a deep dive into.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the motive of the book was to try as best as possible to answer the question of how this new generation of English talent has been developed. So the likes of Marcus Rashford, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Phil Foden, Mason Mount, Jadon Sancho, and of course Bukayo Saka, who we're seeing coming through with England now, how they were developed, also at what cost. I think a lot has been written and understood about the downsides of the academy system in recent years, the negatives of this system that we've learned has swept in 12,000 young people, and the vast majority of whom have discarded at some point. And we've heard a lot about how the treatment of those people and the aftercare they receive or lack thereof, it can be alarming. So I wanted to see what the good work being done is, because obviously there are some really good results being pumped out, not only on the football pitch with all these talented young players who are performing at a really high level and seem to have the world at their feet, but also in producing these well-rounded young people that we're seeing come out the other end as well. But then also to balance that out against the negative side and this, you know, the super high attrition rates that we see, and the real sort of human cost of this system, and as well as the financial side of it. So that's what the book seeks to do. I've spent the last 2 years traveling up and down the country, speaking with various people and visiting academies at all different levels. So I've been to the top of the top, the likes of Man City, Man United, Liverpool, speaking with key coaches and decision makers there, and seeing what's going on the grass and on a day-to-day basis, and then down to the likes of your Fulhams and your Crystal Palaces, the ambitious academies who sit kind of just below them in the food chain, and all the way further down the league at the lower league clubs to see how they're trying to innovate to catch up and fill the gap, and how they make up for a lack of financial might with smart ideas. So Shrewsbury Town were one I visited, Colchester United, even non-league clubs like Kidderminster. I went and had a really interesting afternoon there to see what they're doing. And yeah, I just, as best as possible, tried to paint this really comprehensive picture of the system using case studies from players, likes of Rashford and Trent Alexander-Arnold, speaking with people who were there, who were responsible for their development both on and off the field, and getting real, you know, detailed anecdotes about how they were developed, and also looking and speaking with parents of successful players like Mason Mount. I spoke with Rian Brewster's dad, who was of course very successful with the England youth teams, and parents and players who've been released by academies and feel kind of let down by the game, as well as I spoke with people from governing bodies, people from the PFA, scouts, everyone involved and anyone who has any kind of contact with the system, essentially, I've spoken with, got their perspective and tried to paint this really comprehensive picture of what this big, this great big development machine is like, in what I'm confident is the kind of most comprehensive way that's been done as yet.
Yeah, and also, I mean, anyone that follows the Daily Canon website will know that we also cover quite a lot of, about the Arsenal women's team, and I understand that you spent time with their academy as well.
I did, yes. I met with James Honeyman, the women's academy manager there, had a really kind of in-depth discussion about not only the process at Arsenal and how his predecessor, Tessa, surname is escaping me at the moment, that's embarrassing, I apologise, but how she was an innovator on the women's academy side, and how they drove innovative approaches such as mixed sex training, which was something that is really widespread now, and that was something that Arsenal were at the forefront of. And I spoke with James also about the broader picture of women's youth football, where it is in relation to the current state of the men's game and the boys' game, the discrimination they face, the lack of finance they face in relation to the boys' game, and how that affects their day-to-day work, and where things are heading with the development of the Super League that we've seen in the last few years, and the money that is starting to trickle into the game, and how crucially the women's youth game appears to be at a kind of crossroads that the men's game was at 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see whether they can kind of learn the lessons that the men's game did, or whether they will plough on regardless and fall victim to some of the same pitfalls.
I suppose a good place to start, just for context, and because we have obviously listeners of all age ranges, is obviously the introduction of the academy system was a big shift in English football, certainly at club level, and the way that affected the football pyramid as well, and a lot of people would say it gave perhaps slightly too much power to the elite compared to those lower down the food chain, which is obviously we've seen more and more young talent getting hoovered up by various different clubs. You know, Chelsea and Man City are obviously the most notorious examples of picking up every young talent they can from any lower league club around the country. But just to give some context, what's really been that change? You know, can you tell us just a little bit about what the difference is between how things worked before and what the academy system changed and what that meant for those within it? I mean, in basic terms.
Yes, absolutely. Just to quickly correct my mental block from earlier, Tessa Payne is the name I was searching for, the former Arsenal Women's Academy manager, who was a really influential figure in women's youth football in this country, who recently stepped down from her position and was replaced by James Honeyman. There's a real big historical element in the book. I trace the origins of youth football right back to the 1930s when the first affiliated youth teams were created. The likes of Wolves and Man United were among the first to adopt junior athletic clubs, as they were called at the time, which were begun with the very creditable ambition of fostering a better relationship between the locality of where these clubs are based, and with the aim of bringing through local players and giving them opportunities to play in the first team. Of course, it's developed to a point where it's much more a machine, and finances are a much bigger part of it, and it's become a money generator as much as anything else these days. And of course, there's so many young people swept into the system, as we discussed. I traced it all the way back there. I looked at the importance of the English Schools FA and how that was a predominant force in English youth football for most of football's history in this country up until the last 20, 30 years or so. We also did a really kind of deep dive into Lillishall, the national school, which ran between 1984 and 1999. It was kind of a precursor to the modern academy system as we know it, whereby the best, I think it was the best 14 boys each year were selected at the age of 14. Each cohort stayed for 2 years at Lillishall in the leafy Shropshire countryside, where they were exposed to top level coaching by FA coaches and kind of indoctrinated into the FA way, and with the aim of bringing them through to eventually be England internationals. That was the ultimate aim of this program, and it ran for 15 years, produced a lot of high quality players, the likes of Jamie Carragher, who I interviewed for the book, and got some really, really funny anecdotes from him. Michael Owen was another big name, Sol Campbell. There are dozens and dozens of players who came through that system. So I did a real kind of detailed look back at Lillishall, how that operated and the similarities between what happened there and the current academy system. But the point at which things really changed and the modern academy system as we know it was formulated was just as Lershaw was closed down. Incidentally, it was Howard Wilkinson was the technical director of the FA in 1997. Mm-hmm. He was charged with looking at the English youth football system and revamping it. He looked abroad. He studied what was going on at Ajax and Barcelona, even as far as Sao Paulo. He studied all these foreign clubs and looking at their development techniques and what ages they were bringing in players into clubs and how much contact time they were getting and things like that. His conclusion was that the way things were with schools football at the time being, as I mentioned, the predominant force in youth development, he felt that players were playing far too much football, far too much organised football at a young age, because professional clubs weren't allowed to formally and exclusively sign players until they reached the under-14s level, and they would be signing schoolboy forms. Up until that point, they'd still be playing for their school, they'd be playing for their Sunday league team, and they'd be playing informally with a professional club if they were good enough to be selected for one. And he came to the conclusion that these young boys were playing as many as 100 games a season, and he felt that that overplay was a real issue. So what he did, he closed down Lillishaw, and essentially replicated the model that we saw there and handed the power back to the clubs to implement that themselves, creating what you call the Charter for Quality, which was a set of rules and guidelines that governed English youth football up until 2012, when the Elite Player Performance Plan came in and updated it all, essentially. And that's still the set of rules and guidelines that govern elite youth football in this country. And what EPPP did, some of the more positive things to do, because it is quite a controversial thing that was brought in. Yeah. It raised coaching standards, it raised staffing levels, it raised facility qualities, it put more robust checks in place for things like welfare. It stipulated that clubs who wanted an academy license had to have welfare officers employed on a full-time basis, and it introduced an audit process whereby each club was graded 1 to 4, based on the quality of their facilities and their staffing levels and the package that they were able to offer, with category 1 being the highest and 4 being the lowest. But at the same time, it also brought in some controversial measures as well, not least the fixed compensation system, whereby each player from an under 9s level and up is assigned a value. So it's quite unsavory to think about an 8-year-old being placed, slapped with a price tag on the head, but that's the way it is. Each player within an academy who signed to an exclusive contract, because that was one of the things that the Charter Quality also did. It lowered the age at which young players could be signed from, instead of being at under 14s level, it's now under 9s. And not only did it recommend that, it stipulated that if you wanted an academy license, you had to run an under 9s team and up for in every age group in between. And that's still the case. Now we see that change alone brought in the great swathes of young people who were sucked into the system, and obviously then necessitated the attrition rates and the heartbreak that we've learned so much about over the last few years. And EPPP now, rather than when one club wants to sign a player from another, rather than the clubs agreeing a fee or potentially going to tribunal if they can't agree a fee, there's now this fixed compensation system whereby every player has an assigned value based on how long they've been in an academy and what category level that academy is. The idea of it is to cut out any wrangling and stop players being caught in limbo when a transfer kind of hits the bricks. But it can also be a detriment to young players in that if they want to leave a club, they have to find somebody else who is going to be able to pay their compensation fee. It's been found in the vast majority of cases, up to 80% of cases, clubs have been willing to waive that fee, but that still means a lot of players haven't had that waived, have been caught in it, but there's been some high-profile cases of that. And then it's just, as I said, the very unsavory element of thinking about how these young people have quite hefty price tags attached to their head from a very young age. And then there's the other element of it, looking at it from the smaller club's perspective, who feel that this system undervalues their best talent and leaves them liable to being cherry-picked by the bigger clubs. And that's what we see and how we see so much stockpiling at the very top end of the academy system, and why we've seen a lot of clubs now kind of step away and do things differently and try and operate from outside of the EPPP auspices.
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned clubs that do things differently, and obviously the most discussed example of that, particularly given the success they've had in recent years in terms of transforming their club, is Brentford. Obviously they chose to go in a very different direction. Do you think they will remain an outlier, or do you think that path of sort of abandoning the academy and setting up this B team model to pick up those that haven't necessarily had the full opportunity elsewhere. Do you think more clubs will go down that route, given the difficulties of maintaining or competing with the elite academy status if you've got less resources?
Yeah, I think we will see more people following suit. We have been over the years. Huddersfield being one of the primary examples. I spoke to a guy called David Webb, who is the director of football at Huddersfield for a while, and he told me all about how they looked at Brentford's model and decided to adopt a similar thing. They saw the money that was being saved. They also saw how it withdrew some of the necessary heartbreak that the current academy system, as we know it, does make part of its reality. So what Brentford have done, they closed down their academy. They came in for a lot of criticism at the time because they released all of their academy players, and it caused a lot of anguish for the young people who were released after being training with this club for however many years and feeling as though they were on a pathway to greater things and perhaps a career in the game. They were let go all en masse. And of course, Brentford, yeah, as I said, received a lot of criticism for that, but they would counter that by saying that now we sit outside of this system, we don't need to bring in great swathes of players. They now operate a B team model whereby they have a single B team that sits below the first team. They recruit only players from 16 years of age and up. And they recruit just one squad of players, and each player they believe has a genuine chance of making it to their first team. Everything the B team does mirrors what goes on at first team level to prepare these players for an eventual leap to the first team. So they think they've cracked it in a way that not only has reduced costs and saved them £1.5 million a year, they also feel that it's a more ethical set of protocols and ways of doing things. And that's also what other clubs are finding increasingly as well. But to flip the perspective and look at it and say, what if everybody else in the country adopted that same methodology and operated just a B team rather than dozens of youth teams at different age levels? Then clubs would only be recruiting players from 16 and up. Those players wouldn't be getting formal training until the age of 16, and we wouldn't be seeing the level of play that we're seeing now coming through. Brentford, whether they care to accept this fact or not, are relying on other clubs for training the players that they sign at 16. They don't come straight off the street. They come from other clubs, either young players who've fallen out of academies and been released that they pick up, or players either go and scout and sign. So if everybody adopted that same principle, there'd be a huge gap in the youth development machine that we would need filling somewhere or another.
I mean, it's sort of they almost as if they adapted the model that sort of, you remember the academy that Glenn Hoddle set up that was sort of picking up players that had gaps. It was sort of like they sort of translated that to their own modus operandi. And I guess it's, as you imply, it's all about the balance. You know, there is definitely a place for that mode of operating within the system, because there are, as you discuss, you know, lots of people who for whatever reason don't quite make it at the clubs they're at, and that point of enforced departure is one which many don't recover from or don't see a route towards another opportunity very easily. And of course, you know, the higher Brentford got the ladder, the more elitist that B team is going to be. Mm-hmm. I suppose if down the league system there are more clubs doing that, as long as they're not doing it en masse, then that does sort of provide a sort of a collecting pool for players that otherwise would be lost in the game, and you know, maybe disheartened at it, and without, you know, having focused all their energies in that, then having to completely reassess their lives at the age of 16. You know,
I think ideally a middle ground would be what we'd look to move towards in the future, I would hope. I think it does seem with more and more clubs adopting similar approaches or deciding to reduce their academy offering. Look, Baltimore are a great example of that. Mm-hmm. They were a Category 1 academy just a couple of years ago. Now they've reduced their offering all the way down to Category 4 for cost-cutting measures. And that means that they run fewer age groups, and obviously they spend less on their academy than they used to previously. But at the same time, they have fewer players on their books. So yeah, ideally there would be some kind of middle ground. I don't think it has to be necessary that so many players are taken in by clubs. It shouldn't be the case that so few of the, as a percentage, get through to either a first team opportunity or a career in the game elsewhere. So many at the moment fall through the gaps. I spoke with David Conn, the Guardian journalist, who's done a great deal of work in this area. I spoke to him for the book, and he had a really interesting perspective on it. He said, you've got to kind of flip the way you look at it. If we accept that this is a system that pulls in 12,000 boys at any one time, and that 90 plus percent, whatever, even in conservative estimates, 90 plus percent aren't going to make it to that team or aren't going to have careers in the game elsewhere, then we can't look at it as being a dream factory. It's got to be looked at as a crushing of dreams factory, because that's what they deal in. That's their primary product. The small number of players who make it through at the end are almost incidental. They're almost a byproduct of the system. What the system produces essentially is heartbreak. So more needs to be done and more focus needs to be put on the players who aren't going to make it through, to make sure that regardless of whether they do end up with a career in the game or not, that they don't feel like they've wasted a huge chunk of their lives and their childhoods, that their time spent in these academies has been enriching and they come away with something tangible that can serve them well elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and we've heard sort of a fair amount of discussion about some academies taking that on board to some degree, recognizing mm-hmm. that this is a failing within the system, and that obviously, you know, to a lot of people are very critical of sports people, but to even get close to making it as a sports person in an elite level sport, even if you never do, it requires a level of commitment and prowess that is actually extraordinary compared to most people in most professions. And yeah. These people have had to give that level of commitment, you know, through teenage years, and then suddenly might find themselves not having any avenue to go any further with it. And that, of course, is going to be incredibly psychologically challenging. I mean, one of the things that, you know, obviously from coming from the Arsenal perspective, it was heartening when Mertesacker, I know that he is fairly tight-lipped when he can't control what he's putting out in there, but you know, he was very public about wanting to try and take care of the other side a bit more than had been previously the case, and how his experiences in Germany, you know, mm-hmm. possibly because of his own personal upbringing of being, you know, not the talented kid, and perhaps, you know, the guy who always, everyone was stunned he got anywhere near making it, and look at the career he had, and also perhaps the slightly more middle class environment he grew up in, giving him, you know, he's looking at it from a broader perspective, because he was that person who, for most of his youth career, was expecting to fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were expecting him to fall by the wayside, whereas obviously a lot of people who, you know, who have had successful careers haven't had that level of. They've always been expected to do well, in a way. So, and I was just going to, obviously, as Arsenal fans, we know about what Mertesacker said about that. I was just going to ask you, from those people you've spoken to, you know, do you think that message and the realization of needing to do something a bit broader is being taken on board more fully by academies in general, or is it still very stratified in terms of how people are dealing with that kind of broader responsibility?
Yes, there are kind of two elements to this. I'm glad you mentioned Claire Mertesacker. He's someone I think is really intelligent and really good at what he does, and has that kind of emotional intelligence as well that you need in the role, because the role he occupies is one with incredible responsibility when you think about all the young lives who have been entrusted to him, essentially, in the academy and to his staff. And a lot of people, almost to a person, the coaches I spoke with for this book, and the academy managers, are very cognizant of their responsibility, the gravity of their position. Many of whom would like to see the numbers in academies reduced. They don't see it necessary to have so many players in the academies, and they don't see that this mass heartbreak is a necessary evil of producing top-class young footballers. They would like to see change there. Tony Whelan, Manchester United's assistant academy manager, was someone who was kind of the oracle of my book. I spent 3 hours with him, and it was... just a really, really great conversation, and it runs throughout this book, and it informs a lot of my findings and my studies with it. Tony is someone who, he played for United. He was part of the youth team when Matt Busby was still around. He was the second ever black player to play for United back in the 60s. He then, after he retired, he went into social care. He worked with some of the vulnerable youth of Manchester. He has 3 degrees that he studied for off his own back. He's a really incredible, intelligent and emotionally intelligent man who's got a lot of experience. He's 68 years old now. He's been part of United's youth setup since 1990. I think he's been in his current role for more than a decade. And he's just one of the most revered figures in youth football. And it's really encouraging to... Yeah, for sure. It's very encouraging to know that people like him are in positions such as the one he occupies, because he is very, very aware of his responsibility. And just using Manchester United as an example, they have this philosophy among the coaches that they call writer's mind. It was a term coined by Jim Ryan, the former youth coach there, who worked with the first team out as well around the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And essentially, it's this ethos whereby beyond simply the football coaching element of what they do, the interaction they have and the guidance they give to the young footballers that they're charged with looking after is all around developing their empathetic sides and making them understand their responsibility as people and as young footballers. And so, for example, a lot of young footballers in academies now will be going on foreign trips for tournaments and things from the ages of 9, 10, 11 years old. United and Tony Whelan are very keen to make sure that they don't just see one airport and one set of small-sided pitches and then return home. They want them to experience the cities they're going to, because they're well aware that the majority of these boys aren't going to make it through at the end to be a United player, and most also aren't even going to have a career in the game. So they want to make sure that these experiences are enriching. So they put together little leaflets about the culture of the city, going to visit some key phrases in the local language. They'll go and visit cultural hotspots within whatever city they're going to. So, for example, when they went to Hungary, in Budapest, they visited Puskás's tomb. When they went for a tournament there, they encouraged the young boys to take turns giving speeches to the hotel staff at the hotel they're staying with, to thank them for their work and to present a signed shirt or a club pennant or something like that. And to just be kind of respectful in everything they do and to make sure their rooms are cleaned. He says that, you know, when a maid goes into your room, they should only have to change their bed sheets. They're not there to pick up your litter kind of thing. Just to imbue them with a sense of responsibility and a social awareness and an understanding of other people and appreciation of other people. And while he was quick to say, you know, he wouldn't wish to take credit for anything that Marcus Rashford has done over the last 18 months off the field, he said he's an incredible person. He said what he's been doing is God-given, and he feels privileged just to have known and to have worked with such a special young man. But from the outside looking in, with everything I learned about what they do there, it certainly seems that United provided a kind of breeding ground for those parts of Rashford's personality. They allowed him to explore his empathetic side and to grow as a young person and to grow his social awareness. So it certainly has helped create well-rounded individuals, even, you know, beyond the exceptional work that Rashford is doing. No footballer should be expected to do what he's doing, but this generation certainly seem very switched on, very socially aware. And I think that is a credit to the work being done by the coaches who are working on a day-to-day basis. But then the other element, as I mentioned, is that the system itself, the machine itself, is far less caring. So there are still huge gaps in the aftercare that players released by clubs face, because that's systemic. From what I gather, speaking with governing bodies and speaking with people, decision makers within the game, it feels like they believe they're a lot closer to cracking the issue of aftercare and welfare and proper preparation and feedback mechanisms that mean that when a player does get released, it shouldn't be this hammer blow that crushes them. They feel like they're a lot closer to offering an adequate package than the lived experience of the people I spoke to will suggest. So the people I spoke to who've been released by clubs, who've suffered that indignity of not seeing it coming, of when it does arrive, it being totally impersonal and not in any way reflecting what they feel has been their experience with the club, and have felt the heartache and the crushing blow of one trial after another and rejection upon rejection upon rejection. So there are two key chapters in my book that focus on this element. One is called Dear Parent Guardian, and this focuses on more specifically the younger age group. So before they reach the kind of professional development stage, I was able to reproduce an email that a Premier League club sent to a seven-year-old when they released him, where they sent to his parents. And the chapter is called Dear Parent Guardian because the email began with bracket, Dear Parent Guardian. It was a boilerplate email that was supposed to click and infill the name of the parents and address it to the right person. They didn't bother to do that. At no point did it mention the boy's name or the parent's name. No specific info about his own development, why he was being released, just generic info about, you know, thank you for your son's attendance at our academy. Generally, players who get let go could do with working on this, you know, see you later, basically. Yeah. And he'd been with the club, training informally with them since he was 4 years old. So that's pretty much half of his little life. And he broke his leg playing football, and it was after he recovered. He'd been back at this club for a couple of weeks. Then, with no prior warning, he was unceremoniously let go. There are other examples of young players being let go and kind of falling out of love with the game, falling out of love with life. Sadly, there was one parent told me about how her son was crying in his room after being let go by a second academy that he'd been playing for, and he just said he didn't want to live anymore. To hear that from your 10, 11, 12-year-old boy, it's something no parent should have to go through, not through football, for sure. And then the other chapter looks at slightly older age groups, and that one's called How Much Rejection Can You Take? Because those were the words of a former Fulham player to me, because he was released by Fulham at 16. And again, he praised the work of Hugh Jennings, the academy manager who I met with for this book at Fulham, who's a really switched on chap. He has a background in education, so he's really in tune to the needs and the psyche of a young person. But he felt like the game itself, all these mechanisms that are supposed to be in place, all these protocols about how you're supposed to be contacted and how your aftercare is supposed to be taken care of, he didn't really experience any of that. He was sent on a cycle of trial after trial before he knew it, after being told 1 week he wasn't good enough for Fulham, the next week he wasn't good enough for Brentford, next week he wasn't good enough for Colchester, and before he knew it, he was down playing semi-professional football just to kind of keep his toe in the game. And it was kind of a shell shock to him that over the course of this one summer, he completely had his dreams destroyed, and he felt like there was no real net there to catch him. And he said, how much rejection can you take? Because it compounds and it can be really difficult. So yeah, there are a lot of really good people like Per Mertesacker, like Tony Whelan, like so many others who do the day-to-day work, whose feet touch the turf, who are there working very up close and personal with these young people, and they are tremendously good at what they do and tremendously conscious of their responsibility. But I think the game itself and the system itself is letting too many people down.
Well, just on that specifically, I mean, this is something I've often thought about, but I'm not involved in it sufficiently to know the plausibility. But do you think there is a scope for partnerships between clubs at different levels, so that those kids that, you know, yes, you might not be good enough for Man United at 16 because the pool of talent they have to access is so vast, you know, whether it's Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea, but that there should be a number of other clubs down the pyramid that if you've made it that far into the system of this super club, there should be a lot of others that would be actively interested in you. And do you think that there is any mechanism in place to help that happen? Or is it just a case that when people drop out, you know, unless they've got a particularly caring staff member who can put in a word for them, they're basically on their Todd writing letters and emails and hoping that someone is willing to look at them? I mean, what is the reality of that situation, or is it vary hugely from club to club? Is there a sort of uniformity, or is it just really very different?
So that's a great point and a great question, and it brings to mind a few things from the book that I learned. So almost exactly what you said was echoed by Hugh Jennings, who I mentioned, the Fulham Academy manager, who is great experienced. He was in charge of Southampton's academy when they brought through so many of their great young players in the early 2000s. He was saying, you know, why shouldn't we be able to have a relationship with, for example, Crawley Town, where they can become like a system where we can send our players for development. If they need to be, they can come back. I think the issue there is that, you know, from the club's perspective, from decision makers, from the money men, they would probably be looking for a quid pro quo. So if they're sending some of their talent down to Crawley or whoever it might be, who maybe aren't quite good enough for Fulham at that stage, but would still be excellent players for a level below that, then I think they'd want some kind of feeder system as well that goes back the other way, which then you get into the issue of B team models, which is a lot of objection to within English football.
Doesn't sit well with the history of English football.
No, exactly.
Elsewhere in Europe,
It's kind of a way of, it would kind of be a way of keeping the smaller clubs down almost to have them as feeder clubs to bigger clubs. So I think that's something that, a notion that English football has always kind of rejected. So that maybe that's why that's something that hasn't materialised and doesn't appear to be on the horizon. But also the parent of the young boy I mentioned who closed himself off and his room after being released, he was released first by Liverpool and then by Oldham. He's based up in the Manchester area. After his second release from Oldham, his mum decided to try and do something. She drew up this package for what she called extra time. That was what her program was going to be called. And basically, it was a package which would include a continuation of coaching and training for the boy or girl who is released in accordance with the contract that they have with their club, because they sign one-year contracts at that age. So when they let go, they are still entitled to go back. That's something that she was never told, but only when asked, she said, actually, you know, what about the contract? Can he not come back and train? And they said, well, actually, yeah, you can if he wants to. But of course, the boy doesn't want to go back because all his friends at the club know that he's been released, and it's an issue of embarrassment for the boy. So she came up with this idea of having clubs further down the food chain essentially fill that gap and continue to offer them coaching, while at the same time they have peer support from other players who are slightly older who've been through similar things. Yeah. They have counselling if they feel they need it. So she came up with this whole initiative, and she tried to get support from within the game for that, and she's faced nothing but closed doors, and still that's the case to this day. As I said, the game itself seems to think it's doing a better job of filling those gaps than it really is. And it's a similar thing at the high levels as well, the older age groups rather. There's a guy called Paul Mitton who was a young player at Manchester United in the mid-90s. He was actually part of the class of 93, so he came after the very famous class of 92. And as such, I think, because they offered so many contracts to the players from the class of 92, class of 93 were always going to be thin on the ground. So he was released quite unceremoniously from United, despite being at the age of sort of 14, 15, 16, one of the better prospects in the whole country. So he really struggled.
His name is
evident. Exactly. Yeah. Also, his granddad played for United, Charlie Mitton. His cousin Andy is quite a well-known journalist around Man United. Andy Mitton is a quite well-known Manchester United journalist. He really struggled in the game as a young player and kind of fell out of love with it. And it was only years later, when he was well into his 30s, that he kind of could reapproach football and have any kind of relationship with the game. He works now as a personal trainer, and he started working with players around the age of 18 and up who have been released by clubs in the Northwest, so the United, Cities, Liverpools. And he offers them a package whereby he can train them fitness-wise and get ready for this trial process, that if they want to stay in the game, that is the next step for them. Because inevitably, the players who have been released tend to be the ones who haven't been getting much game time because it's been on the fringes of the side. So when they go on these trials, they're not ready, they're not fit enough. So he gets them fit again. He can give them football coaching because of his background in the game. He's got connections with people who can offer proper counselling, and he's also got connections with people who can help find trials. His program is called Revive. He runs it out of a gym that he works with. He's approached people within the game, clubs and governing bodies, and again found no support for his program. He'd like to franchise it out to make it something that every boy in the country is released, every girl in the country is released, has access to, but he's faced nothing but closed doors. Also, he told me, and it's something I wrote about in the book, about how he sat down with Manchester City. He said the people that he was speaking with just had no idea about what he was saying. Really, they weren't the right people. They didn't really understand what the experience of a young released footballer is like. Exactly. So City and many clubs have welfare teams. As I said, that's part of the package at academies. Now they have these welfare teams. So when players are released, they check up on them and check on their well-being. But it's usually a fairly impersonal phone call from somebody this player has no prior relationship with. So as Paul Mitton was saying, you know, when a young boy of 16, 17, 18 gets a phone call from somebody who doesn't know, they're asking if he's all right, he's just going to say, yeah, he's not going to want to open up to them. And Paul Mitton was saying, it's not a phone call. A phone call is just ticking a box. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be a real care package put in place. And as I said, he went to Man City and he said to him, look, the way things are going, I hate to say, but someday you're going to release the player and that boy's going to go away and take his own life. And lo and behold, a few months later, the Jeremy Wister story broke, a really preventable tragedy. And again, as I said, he's been trying to link up with governing bodies and whatnot and had no success. In terms of how players go about getting trials as well, as you mentioned, there are these exit trials, which have been likened to cattle markets for young players. So it's these events that they often take place at a small non-league ground or at for universities facilities, whereby players have been released by academies either in the EFL or the Premier League and invited to these sort of mass trial events where they're put together with players they have no prior relationship with, they have no sort of on-field chemistry with, they're often asked to play out of position, and then they get a run out essentially in front of an assemblement of scouts from all up and down the league, and a percentage of those will get offers to go and train with another club and have a trial elsewhere. That is pretty much the game's offering to the players released in terms of, unless it's a club who offers something off their own back or a coach who is willing to kind of go the extra mile and dig into his contacts book.
I mean, that sort of leads me to my next question, which is, do you think that the academy system has made the very well-known stories, I suppose, would be people like Ian Wright or Jamie Vardy, that made those transitions harder? Is it created more of a closed shop for those who aren't quite good enough early enough to get into it?
I think that's probably the case. It's probably something that's difficult to say because
yeah, sure.
You never know what would happen if a really bright talent emerged outside of our league. Jamie Vardy is a fairly recent example. So, he came up in the era of academies. But what my guess would be that there's kind of would be a mistrust maybe from the higher levels of the game of a player who has been missed by the academy system. They'd be wondering why and whether their lack of formal training would be something that would hold them back. So if a club now was looking at an Ian Wright, for example, as he was back in the day when he was playing non-league football before he went to Palace, they'd be wondering why he didn't get picked up sooner. Is there some kind of attitude problem? Of course, I think he'd done some prison time as well, which of course, I guess, would have counted against him now in the game, especially when so much gets dredged back up from these young players' personal lives. I guess they're looking at whether somebody who's been outside of the system so long could kind of be indoctrinated into it at such an older age, when for the most part players now, even though academies can't formally sign players, as I mentioned, until the under-9s level, most of the young players you see breaking through now will have been training with a professional club since the age of 5 or 6. You know, Mason Mount's been at Chelsea since he was 6. Trent Alexander-Arnold's been at Liverpool since he was 6. Rashford's been at United since he was 7. You know, they've been in this system and fully kind of indoctrinated into it from such a young age that it's just part of the course for them. It's part of their lives. It's how they've grown up. It's probably a difficult world to infiltrate if you come into it later in life.
Well, picking up on those examples and also something point you made earlier, obviously one of the things that's been talked about that during the European Championships has been the way that the England players, and particularly the younger ones, have conducted themselves, not just with professionalism, but just the way that they carry themselves, the way they seem to be. More of them seem to be more willing to stick their head above the parapet and sort of actually get involved in issues that they've historically have been told to keep their nose out of. And we've already seen, obviously, we've seen the tension between our current government wanting to try and ride on the coattails of football, but also keep the footballers back in their quiet little box and do what they're told. Do we think that's something which is more attributable to the personalities of the individuals and the changing level of awareness of young people due to the information age? Or do you think that the academy system is actually fostering that in a way that is perhaps more complete than we've seen and of other people from similar backgrounds, I guess?
Again, it's both, I would suggest. I would say it's more a case of the former, as you laid out there very eloquently. It's this new generation of young people that they're a part of that, you know, are more switched on, more generally empathetic type of human being that's been created by this new information age, as you said. But certainly academies are more in tune to that now than they used to be. I think there's much less of a dictatorial approach. In the book, I delved into some of the previous kind of welfare issues that were rife within the academy system. So looking at the abuse scandal that has been in the news fairly recently, looking back throughout, speaking to survivors and looking at what's being done now to prevent those real travesties happening again. But also looking at some of the bullying that occurred at academies from coaches who were charged with the welfare of these young boys who were entrusted to them, and how young people felt mistreated by some of the coaches, and some very robust methods that probably would have been written off as character building 20, 30 years ago that now just the newer generation aren't willing to accept. And I think rightly so. So there's a much more respectful approach. Of course, discipline is still a huge element of any young person's development, and that's still a key part of academy life and preparing the young player for a life in the game. But there's definitely more empathy and more switched on approach to the development of young individuals. So, for example, all the things I mentioned with Marcus Rashford and the writer's mind philosophy at Manchester United, I believe Liverpool have their young players take turns volunteering at homeless shelters in the city. A lot of clubs are doing multi-sports programs now and exposing the kids to different sports and letting them just kind of learn different things and interact with people in different ways. So Fulham, for example, I think have had like judo courses or rugby, or it's just given a chance for these kids to be kids and develop as young individuals. And Burnley, who I visited and met with their academy manager, they would, for the younger players, being fully aware of how much time these young boys and girls in their system are giving up to the game, on occasions where they have a scheduled training night, they'll kind of sack off football and say, okay, today we're all going to cinema, we're having a social evening, we're going to just, the kids are going to be kids. So that all goes into this this general understanding of the people, again, who are doing the day-to-day work, of the importance of their role and their responsibility to these young people and their development as people and as young adults.
I mean, the next question, I mean, Dan, who writes for, Dan Critchlow, who writes for the Daily Canon, particularly covering the academy and the youth prospects, me and him are the two youth team geeks. I mean, I don't know if this is a question that's easy to answer, but I mean, do you think over the last decade, things are getting better or worse for young players in general, and particularly for those that don't make it? Is there a sense of a direction of travel in that particular?
Yeah, more is being done. More still needs to be done, a lot more. But yeah, I think things are better now than they used to be. For all the things we discussed, just how in tune most of the coaches I met seem to be with their young players, how aware a lot of them are now, and how practiced they are in the art of managing young people from different backgrounds and dealing with diversity and being sensitive to that. That's something I spoke to Gary Uss at the Crystal Palace Academy manager about, of course, situated in the South London hotbed, one of the richest talent hotbeds in all of Europe. It's comparable to the Parisian suburbs for the sheer level of talent that comes from this really small location. But it's also a really diverse place, a place that's a real melting pot culturally. And he said it was a bit of a learning curve for him to understand, you know, he comes from leafy Bedfordshire, a middle class background, and to learn on the job effectively was what I was tasked with, of how to deal with people from different backgrounds. He cited the example of a young boy who was consistently late to training. His initial instinct was to discipline the boy, to punish him in some way. But the more he learned about the background the boy was coming from, he learned that it was important within the culture that from which he came that he finished all his chores around the house before he did anything extracurricular. So you have to be more understanding that this wasn't the boy's fault. This was just part of his upbringing. So you have to be understanding of that. And just on my visit to Crystal Palace that day, I used the example in the book of how just sat a few metres apart in the canteen there was Will Duncan, who's a former Chelsea player. They sent him from Chelsea. He was, I believe, a Chinese Taipei international. He was Eton educated, sat across from Ryan Innes, who comes from a really difficult background in South London, who I believe his parents had addiction issues, and he's been in prison before for fighting and things like that. I think GBH is when he was convicted. He's come from a really difficult background. He had to play a really big role in the upbringing of his young siblings from you know, before he was an adult himself. So he's had a really difficult background, and to kind of balance the two and to understand how each individual has to be treated as an individual, and this one-size-fits-all approach that we would have seen a few decades ago is no longer fit for purpose. And I think it's encouraging that it's trending in that direction, even though there are still, as I mentioned, so many gaps in aftercare and in feedback mechanisms and things like that.
The other thing that Dan wanted to know, and I appreciate you probably can't and don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but are there any... Rather than asking, are there any, say, more high-profile clubs which are struggling in terms of how they're caring for those within the academy system? Sort of from what you've discussed and the people you've spoken to and people you've met, are there? You've obviously mentioned Man United and you've mentioned Fulham and Palace. You know, are there clubs that really are leading the way in terms of getting the balance better? That really spring out to you that you think are modellas, you know, exemplars for the rest of.
I think a lot of academies now are doing things fairly well. Certainly in house, I think it's a systemic issue, as I mentioned. I think the sheer numbers necessitate a level of heartbreak, which I don't think is healthy. And I think that's the issue that's ripe for revolution. You know, I don't think we need 12,000 young boys in the academy system. And I think, as I said, most coaches who I spoke to within the game agree. They would like to see something like what Bayern Munich have adopted in the last year or two, where I think it's up to the age of 12 now. They've said they're not going to recruit players. They're just going to leave them to be kids. I appreciate Bayern are in a very unique position in German football, whereby they are the dominant force. They know they can kind of let players below the age of 12 go elsewhere in the foreknowledge that if another club gets one of the best talents, they'll just go and pluck them away anyway at some stage. They will end up at Bayern if they're good enough. That's the ultimate goal of any young German footballer, it seems. That's not the case in England. We have a real, I call it the arms race for talent. That's my name, the chapter all about recruitment. That's really what it is. There's a real drive. That's what's driving a lot of the attrition, a lot of the stockpiling that's so negative for young footballers' development. It's how the machine drives this churn towards stockpiling of young players and this fear of missing out essentially on young talents. So while it might be in everyone's best interest to say, okay, we're not going to recruit players from the age of 10 until they're 10, 11, 12 now, the one club who zigs when everyone else zags and decides to hoover up all the best talent at 9 and 8 years old, they stand to gain most. So everyone just continues on the path that they're on. So I think those would be the kind of driving forces behind the ills of the academy system at the moment, that and the kind of systemic need for better aftercare. Whereas I think on a club-to-club basis, most are doing some good work, some admirable work. I know Wolves employ some full-time psychologists who work with released players. I know City have a team of people who try to find opportunities for players released, so to link up with other clubs. They have a team who will work towards doing that. And I know, almost again to a person, the coaches who are doing the day-to-day work are looking after the people who are in their care and help set them up as much as they can and dip into their contacts book and look after them once they've been released, even though that's not really what they're employed to do. And they see so many numbers come through their care and their control that it's probably impossible for them as an individual to really care for everybody that gets released from underneath them in an adequate manner. So while I'm not aware of any one example of a club doing things really badly or any one club doing things to a really exceptional standard, I think, as you mentioned, the direction of travel is encouraging. And then the issues, I feel, are more broad in scope than any one club.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask about is also we've seen a bit of a trend in recent years, both with, slightly older age groups, the highest profile being Jadon Sancho, but also, and players going abroad, like obviously Musiala that's gone to Bayern from Chelsea, and quite a number of Chelsea youth products have found their way onto the continent. And, Benfica and Dortmund and other clubs in recent years, and some make it and some don't to varying degrees. But we're starting to see, I think there seems to be a slight increase in young players at 15, 16 transferring to rival clubs domestically. For instance, Arsenal have just gained Amani Richards, who's a young player who was at Chelsea, who's obviously very highly thought of and is now a very very highly thought of Arsenal prospect as opposed to a Chelsea prospect. Do you think that that's something we're going to see more of? And also, do you think that those clubs who, shall we say, are more notorious for stockpiling talent and hoovering it up, that for them... that it's going to be the importance of a clarity of pathway is going to lead to a lot more kind of club hopping, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it really could. And it's a really interesting point again. As you mentioned, at around 14 years of age, before the players reach the professional development phase, I believe, it's either a gap between the youth development phase and the and the foundation phase or the gap thereafter. When they reach around 14 anyway, they have this opportunity to explore other avenues because their two-year contract with their club ends, and if they want to go elsewhere, then they can start to look at other options, and the best players in the country then do start to be recruited by all the top academies, because every Category 1 academy in the country, one of the benefits of being Category 1, one of the benefits of being one of these academies who offers not only the best facilities and the best coaching and staffing levels and has attained Category 1 status and pumps the most money into their academies, one of their rewards for that is that they're where most clubs below Category 1 level, all clubs below Category 1 level, are restricted to recruiting within a 90-minute catchment area, a 90-minute drive catchment area radius of their academy. Category 1 clubs can recruit nationally from the age of 14. So when these players at 14 come to the end of that two-year contract, every Category 1 club in the country is starting to look at the best talent and make offers and start to court these players and their parents. And I spoke to...
probably the most visible in terms exactly, of getting people all over the country.
Jadon Sancho being, of course, a really high-profile one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been some movement between City and United in recent years as well. I think when I was in Charlotte McNeil, the young striker who's doing really well at United came from City. But anyway, I spoke with Mason Mount's dad, Tony. Mason was the subject of offers from from. He didn't want the clubs to be named in the book, but there were two really big Premier League clubs, Chelsea level clubs, who really wanted Mason when he was 14. They made a great proposal. Tony went and met with them. They had this video package laid out. They had his development plan laid out for him. The works. They put together this really attractive package, and Tony was looking at it, and at the time no Chelsea players were coming through because essentially Mason was the one who ultimately broke that cycle. And Tony was counselling Mason. They had this family meeting in the kitchen, which is, again, it's all in the book, all these details. They called a family meeting at the kitchen of the family home. The uncles, the aunties, the grandparents, the mum and dad were all there, and they were saying to Mason, look, you know, we've seen all these great talented players older than you who've kind of reached the glass ceiling at Chelsea and not made it through to the first team. We've got a couple of really good offers here from top clubs who are saying you're going to have a chance of really making it there. Should we go and look at them? And then that was on the boy. They left it up to the boys, as it should be. And he said, no, I've been at Chelsea since I was six. This is where I want to be. This is my home. This is, you know, I'm going to kind of live and die by this Chelsea academy. And it worked out for him. But then on the flip side, I spoke to Rian Brewster's dad, who at the same age was having the same offers. He decided to move. He went from Chelsea to Liverpool. So that's something we're seeing, this kind of real kind of courtship from category one academies of the best talent from the ages of 14, and lots of switching clubs at the top end. And again, abroad is a big factor, it's enticing for these young players too, when you look at the number of players who get opportunities in the Premier League versus the number of players who get opportunities, for example, in the Bundesliga. In the book, I was able to produce some numbers looking at the average age of squads in the Bundesliga. At the time that I did, there was no club in the Premier League whose squad was of an average age as low as the average in Germany. Even the Champions League clubs in Germany, Bayern and Dortmund and Leverkusen and whoever else it might be, had lower average ages than clubs at any level in the Premier League. So obviously there's a greater trust and greater faith in young players there. And of course, I'm sure Man City's players would have been looking at Jadon Sancho as an example. I know for a fact that Jude Bellingham looked at Dortmund and chose them purely based on their pathway. It wasn't for financial reasons or anything like that. I have a big long piece about Bellingham coming out in the next World Soccer magazine. So I spoke to a lot of coaches who worked with a lot of close friends who were there, and who, you know, who were at his house when he made the decision. They knew it was all about pathways, seeing what had gone on with Jadon Sancho. So I think what was really key was Phil Foden getting through at City. Kind of justified their programme. He was a canary down the coal mine, I think, for a lot of City's young players who probably would be jumping ship now were it not for the fact that this player who has been pointed at as day one as the example of the ultimate professional, the guy who's done everything they've told of him, the supernatural talent who was destined for great things. He listened, he followed instructions. And if he wasn't going to make it, then what chance did anyone else have? And fortunately for City, he's got through and has made it now. And I think he is justifying their programme. Of course, City, one of the clubs they visited, they have this bridge that runs between their academy stadium and the Etihad that crosses a big road there. And of course, you know, it's there for practical reasons to aid foot traffic across a really busy road, but it's also a pretty obvious on-the-nose metaphor for what they're trying to achieve there. And without Foden getting through, you'd have to say it would have been a completely empty metaphor. But now he's well, hopefully for the young players coming behind him, he has kind of opened the doorway and shown a pathway. So it's really key for clubs who want to hold on to their best talent, like you said, to be able to demonstrate a pathway, because players now are, I think it's a generational thing as well. They're open to going elsewhere and exploring new cultures, and aren't afraid of that. They're quite independent and quite sort of single-minded in their focus and their ambition. So, yeah, it's going to be really, really important for clubs to demonstrate pathways above anything else, really, which I think hasn't always been the case.
And I think that's also, you know, as us as the general population become more aware of attrition rates, so the kids within the system, and they, you know, they know that their career might, if they don't get a chance, it could be done in 3 years, you know, at a top pro level. And so they're obviously both for very practical, prosaic reasons, but also for reasons of the romance and dreams of their career, are looking to make those moves. I mean, obviously Bellingham's an interesting one because he was within a sniff of joining Arsenal, apparently, from what I've been told. And, you know, I mean, no one can argue that going to Dortmund was the right decision. But I suppose as an Arsenal fan and on an Arsenal podcast, you know, we have to take comfort from the fact that Arsenal are a team that overtly give slightly more opportunities to younger players. Mm-hmm. I mean, that may be partly due to the paucity of some of their senior recruitment. but the fact is that there's always been, except possibly when you had the Invincibles era where, you know, to get anywhere near the squad, you had to be brilliant. But aside from that, there's always been that pathway, you know, right from, you know, going going back from the 30s is a consistent theme throughout the club. You know, as soon as they stopped just buying and tenant from outside, once they got established in the late 20s, early 30s, that has been a focus of the club. And the contrast that you mentioned, you know, Foden as the shining light, and also Chelsea's transfer ban may have been the best thing to happen for them strategically.
Absolutely, yeah. It's always that confluence of factors, isn't it? It was never going to happen on its own. They needed that kind of push over the cliff edge, and it came along in the form of, I guess, of Lampard having a pre-existing relationship with Tomori and with Mason Mount from Derby, and then of course the transfer ban was a huge thing. Had that not happened, maybe Mason Mount would be playing somewhere else now. Who knows?
Yeah, and also it provides that key marker for the kids behind, because how long it had been since Chelsea, you know, John Terry, hadn't it? You know,
yeah.
And Spurs have been notoriously quite bad at producing youth players.
City as well. It was Mickey Richards before Phil Foden. So you're talking 15 years or more.
And that's when City were a very different club. You know,
exactly. Yeah.
You know, it was Michael Richards. It was Johnson. You know,
Johnson, of course. Yeah. We're talking not only a decade or more later. We're talking £200 million plus of investment in the youth system later before another one came along. So Foden was a real crucial one, I think, in a lot of ways for City.
And in the same way, you know, for Spurs, I mean, everyone, Tim Sherwood does not have the best reputation amongst fans, but you know, he was the first guy to actually try and utilize the Spurs youth system in a very long time. And all right, not all of them stayed, and not all of them totally worked out. But without him, does anyone really believe that Harry Kane was going to get a look in?
Being sent off
unproductive loan spells around the UK, you know. So it is about these club philosophies, and of course, with this arms race that you refer to, there's going to be, everyone wants to show themselves to be, we're the ones that can give you the opportunity. And of course, it is that balance between first team success and the glory and the prizes and the riches, and actually the clubs that will provide those opportunities. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that evolves, as you say, the cohorts coming up now are a lot more aware of their careers and a lot more aware of what these things mean. And you know, and as an Arsenal fan, we're also very heartened that whatever Mikel Arteta is telling the young players at the club at the moment, most of them, you know, who are coming up below the first team level, seem to be renewing and seem to be buying into the fact that he does seem to have an idea about a pathway. And maybe that's partly influenced by his time at Man City, and maybe it's partly what Arsenal are as a club, and perhaps even, you know, indirectly some input from Mertesacker or whatever. And obviously what we've all seen from Arsene Wenger's time in charge, there was always an opportunity if you could break through. But moving away from that, I've got two other questions really that I've been wanting to ask someone for a while, and you seem like as well placed as anyone I can think of to ask them, which is firstly, you know, we're seeing not just with this England national team, but also within both the Premier League, the Bundesliga, as we're discussing, and elsewhere, there is a strength in depth in talent of English footballers at present, even if we do nick a couple of them from Ireland. But although they came through in British academy.
Yeah, steal them back once we realise they're good enough. Yeah.
But is this something which we should be looking at this as a potentially exceptional generation, as, you know, golden generations, yada, yada, yada? Or is it something that we think this is, you know, you have reason to believe this might be a sustainable level of a bit like the French system, where once they got Clairefontaine and moved beyond just being Clairefontaine, then they've just got a sustainable path production line of incredibly high potential talent. And you know, do feel free if you want to bring into that the things about ethnic diversity and the impact that has as well. But I just wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Yeah, I think it certainly has legs beyond the very kind of current crop that we're seeing at the moment in the England team doing so well, beyond being just, you know, like with the golden generation that you mentioned of the early 2000s, where it was this 6, 7, 8 players who were real fantastic world-class players. It seems now that there's a greater depth to it. Whether the top-end talent is at the same level, only time will tell, because, you know, we're still a fair way away from their peak. But I think there's a depth and a pipeline which has a greater flow to it than the golden generation. That seemed more a result of just good fortune almost in many ways, because there was no sort of joined up plan to produce those players. Well, that seems to be the case now, that there's much more of a common thread of thought that's producing these players. It is reliant on the base level of talent being there. The nature versus nurture debate is one that I don't have any answers to, but you know, you do need that, I guess, that base level of talent to be able to exploit it and develop it in the right ways. But what we seem to have now in this country is some best practices that really work. The proof is in the pudding of what we're seeing now. These young technical players, our game has looked outwardly for so long to influences from Spain and Germany, and looked at how they developed World Cup winning level crops of talent and generations of players, taking aspects from that, and now for all accounts we're being looked to as the example. So it's got to be a case of, you know, relying on that sort of base level of talent to keep coming. There's no reason to think it's not replicable. At the same time, it's going to be about keeping those best practices fresh, because all methods become outdated at some point. Innovation is the name of the game in youth football, as it isn't anything else. So it's about staying ahead of the curve, keep, you know, not thinking that we've cracked it and thinking, you know, this is the way it's going to be forever. Just keep going and keep evolving. There are still holes in the system which need to be addressed, both in terms of the welfare, but I'm sure there are ways of doing even better on the coaching side than we currently are. So I think, yeah, to answer your question as succinctly as possible, I think there are certainly legs for this to go longer than just one generation of players. It seems to me to be the result of best practices that have been put in place over the last decade or so, of a direction of travel of a couple of decades worth of evolution of this system, of trial and error, and now reaching the point where the people doing the coaching and in charge of the day-to-day development of these players are exceptional at their jobs and are all open to learning off one another, and have reached a kind of not so much a kind of Midas touch, but certainly a methodology that works really well for harnessing the talent that is at their disposal.
I mean, certainly one thing that seems to be clear is that, you know, the improvement, I mean, obviously we could talk about Wenger again, but the improvements in the UK in terms of helping players reach their athletic potential is, you know, for those of us who've been playing football for 30 years or more, you know, then it's really very clear. Same with the technical level. You know, it's sort of thinking back to watching people on, you know, mud baths in the 80s and just saying what players can do. You know, even the players that can't get a sniff of first team football now, what they can do with the ball compared to many that we saw in perhaps our childhoods. But obviously it's the mental aspect which seems to be getting a lot more attention as sort of like the next frontier to try and work out a crack. And, you know, as some people who listen to this might know, I'm an actor as well. I do some voiceovers for things, and one of the things I was doing was actually voicing an explainer for a system in developing speed of thought and decision making and good decision making in young players. And it was a whole kind of, you know, system involving different colors and lights and whatever. And I guess that's what we're going to see. That's going to be the interesting challenge, because the marginal gains in the physical and technical side, I guess, are getting more and more marginal you know, there is only so far you can push the human body, and there is only so many, you know, millimeters of the ball bouncing off you in a first touch, you know, you can reduce it down to. So I think that's going to be where we're going to see the innovation next, I think, you know, and also then you'll end up with the psychological, but that's obviously harder to steer, I guess. But, you know, hopefully, you know, what you've been talking about in terms of giving these people a more well-rounded and less dictatorial environment in which they can actually form their own personalities, to take more responsibility to themselves, you know, and also be encouraged to think more deeply about what they're doing rather than just follow orders. But the other question I wanted to ask you is, you know, this is very much an Anglo-centric question in terms of the academy system, but Brexit. And obviously we all know that there's a huge homegrown tax when it comes to player transfer. Mm-hmm. And do we think that the collapse of the finances of a lot of other European leagues in terms of transferring players, you know, we've got the tension between the cost of homegrown players compared to the cost of continental players, but also the fact that Brexit, you know, ultimately means that there is going to be a greater importance in domestic league producing players. What do we think that means for the academy system? And do we think that's going to possibly provide slightly more opportunities, you know, compared to, say, the last 10 years where it's been, you know, if you need a player, you go and buy them from France or you know, or maybe Germany?
Yeah, what I found really interesting around the whole Brexit thing was since the vote was ratified and between the vote being cast and set and then implemented, whatever it was, 2.5 years later, a lot of clubs kind of dipped their toe quite deeply into the European market before that tap was turned off. Manchester United in particular were one who seemed to be bringing in 5 or 6 players from within EU countries every transfer window between the ages of 16 and 18, which of course you can no longer do. So what I think it does is for young British players in academies, it kind of extends their timeline a little bit. Whereas previously, they'd have come to the under 16s, under 18s level and found competition suddenly rife because of the influx of, certainly within the bigger clubs, the influx of expensive, to a degree, European players who have come in and now competing for places with them. So whereas at the previous age groups, they might have been one of the standout talents and had a relatively easy time of finding minutes on the pitch. Competition for those places suddenly becomes a lot stiffer. Now it seems as though they're going to have an extra couple of years of game time, essentially, because the foreign players aren't going to be imported until 18 or so, by all accounts. And I think we'll also see, once you reach the age of 18, perhaps South America and Africa being looked to more for young talent than Europe and the EU. So those are going to be the key changes, I think. But yeah, to your point, I think what it does is essentially slightly extend the timeline. And what would be interesting there is to see whether that is going to kind of furrow a path for slightly later developers. So kids who had to kind of be there and at the top of their class at 15, 16, now have those extra couple of years of grace to kind of explore themselves and explore their game. Again, I mentioned I went to Crystal Palace today and met with the academy manager there, and he was telling me about how I did a lot of work in the book around Aaron Wan-Bissaka and his development and how that worked, because I found it really interesting how he kind of switched positions very late in the day in terms of being sort of 18 before he even was exposed to playing right back, and then was thrown into the frying pan at first team level at 20, or I think he was 20 when he had that rough games of playing Arsenal, Spurs and United. I think it was in his first 3 games as a senior footballer. But he was saying, you know, Aaron was considered for release at 14. He was a struggling winger who didn't stand out from the pack in any way. He kind of scraped through the selection processes and managed to stay alive in the academy for an extra couple of years, and then by 18 he's one of the best right backs around at that level, and he went to thrive at first team level very quickly because of those extra 2 years of training. So maybe we'll see more cases like that. He said Zaha was similar as well. Zaha at 15, he couldn't tell you whether he was going to go and have a career in the game. You know, you could see his talent, but he wasn't necessarily top of the class. And of course, by sort of 18 or so, he's in the team and he's thriving. So cases of these late developers in an industry that tends to have very little patience for anybody. That's what young players need. They need patience, especially when they get to the first team level. They need to be allowed to make mistakes and learn from them. They need that trial and error process. It's a necessary part of their development. Now the homegrown players have probably got that little bit extra grace to explore that.
And obviously, as an Arsenal fan, I have to reflect on the fact that, you know, of course Harry Kane was famously in Arsenal's youth system, and he recovered suitably from deemed not good enough. I mean, just before we finally finish this off, and we're pretty much there, but I just wanted to ask you if there's anything from what you've heard that can give Arsenal fans, given this is an Arsenal podcast, any cause for optimism from what you've seen and heard, whether it be about the pathway or the setup at Arsenal or the kids within the Arsenal Academy at various different levels and the turnover of coaching staff. And also applying that to Arsenal women, who I know obviously you've had a bit more contact with.
Yeah, so it's kind of some of the things you touched upon, the pathway being there and being quite clear for young Arsenal players is something that Arsenal fans can be really encouraged by, because we are seeing talented players come through and they're given the chance to impose themselves at first team level and kind of sink or swim, which is what they need. It's what every player cries out for. It's what so many players at City and Chelsea have struggled for over the last 5-10 years and have only recently started to get on in very small numbers. Arsenal have been doing that for a long time. And then on the men's and boys side, having Perma Saka in charge, I think, is a really encouraging thing. He's a very smart guy who's very switched on to the needs of the young people at his command, and I think he's a really good steady hand on the tiller for Arsenal's direction of travel as a youth academy. And then on the women's side, again, as you mentioned, I met with James Honeyman, the academy manager there, looked at all the work he's doing and how Arsenal have been kind of ahead of the curve in terms of developing young females and all the things they're doing now with mixed sex training and how they're developing their best young players. And I think they're still kind of market leaders in that respect. And that, again, from an Arsenal fans perspective, that's as encouraging a thing as you could wish to hear.
Well, of course, the problem that Arsenal women have had is producing too many prospective young female footballers for them to actually be able to accommodate, and hence the amount of Arsenal-produced products that have ended up succeeding at other teams. Just because.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because I spoke with James Honeyman about this. The women's system as it is at the moment, it's different. It's not under the auspices of ECCC as the men's game is, as the boys' game is. It's overseen by the FA, and they're not actually even known as academies. They're known as regional training centres, and they have a similar sort of tiered system to the boys' side, but without such robust checks and balances for player movement. So while, as we mentioned, the aspect of fixed compensation in the boys' game is somewhat controversial, James was explaining how the women's game is crying out for something similar, because at the moment there's no recourse for compensation for a club who loses a player to another team. So there's complete freedom of movement, which you could say is great for young players to be able to do that, but at the same time it discourages clubs from investing fully in the development of these young girls, because they're fearful of losing their best talents to a rival and not receiving anything back the other way. So as you mentioned, losing players for the clubs is something that the women's game is struggling with at the moment, and it is something that I expect will be part of any changes that the game goes through as it becomes more and more popular. As the WSL grows and as the money comes into the women's game, then those kind of structures need to be put in place to ensure that clubs feel confident investing in the development of their young players.
Great. Well, I mean, thank you so much for giving us your time, Ryan. It's. I mean, I've really enjoyed this. It's been really informative, and I've been able to, as I say, ask some questions which I've been mulling over for quite some time, being someone who's interested in, you know, both the academy system and Arsenal, and obviously just human development as a whole. So plug time, remind us of your book, its name, where people can get it from, and what day it's released.
So it's The Dream Factory, Inside the Make or Break World of Football's Academies. It's available at all the usual places. You can pre-order it now, and it will be released on the 5th of August. On the day we're recording today, I've actually just received my advance copy, so I'm very excited to get my hands on it, and I'm really looking forward to everybody else who's interested in it to be able to pick up a copy too. And if you sound interested, please do consider checking it out and seeing if it'll be something that might float your boat.
I did see your unboxing video, and also just a reminder, if you pre-order rather than waiting for it to be released, you get 23% off, certainly at Amazon. Anyway, so basically, if you want to know more about the academy system and you found this chat interesting and want to go a bit deeper, as if you're interested enough in this, you probably should do, go and pick up the book. I'm sure it's going to be an absolute blast. I can't wait to get my hands on my copy. And hopefully maybe at some stage we'll have you on again, Ryan, and have a bit of a recap when we see what has changed.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, thank you.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks again, listeners, if you got this far. I hope you've enjoyed this. As I said, I've enjoyed it very much. And thanks to you, Ryan, for giving up your Wednesday evening when we're recording this. And yeah. We'll be back speaking to you very soon. Obviously, there's going to be some movement on Arsenal news. The pre-season is in full swing. Perhaps the real fixtures will be upon us only too soon. And hopefully, by the time you hear this, there'll be a bit more transfer business taking place. And we'll have a confirmation, indeed, of an academy player signing a new contract rather than rumours, being Kiddo Taylor Hart. So that would be good news, given his leap forward and his development in the last 12 months. Anyway, have a great week, everyone, and look after yourself. Cheerio.